Now, the World Meteorological Organization has warned that a warming climatic event in the coming months, combined with human-induced climate change, will have far-reaching repercussions for health, food security, water management and the environment. It's in line with what science has been saying. We've made no cutbacks to addressing it. John Gibbons is an environmental journalist and joins us on the programme now. John, thanks very much for your time this morning.
Good morning, Greg.
Right, so how would they, what have they considered in coming up with this warning?
Well, I guess the WMO, which is part of the United Nations, which under which we have the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, essentially these are the folks who I guess moderate all the scientific research around climate, its impacts, forecasting, modelling, etc. So these are the, I guess this is really the last word, if you like, in our understanding of our changing climate. So, and I guess what the WMO are saying in this latest projection, as you said in your introduction, I guess the best way I can put it is that we're heading into uncharted territory. It's probably worth considering that in the 10 or 11,000 years since the last ice age ended, we've been in a period of Earth history known as the Holocene. Now, that period, that entire 10, 11,000 years, average global surface temperatures have never exceeded 1 degree above what we call pre-industrial. It's been a remarkably stable period. And of course, that stability is the reason why we were able to develop agriculture, the reason why our cities and our civilizations expanded in this very stable, very predictable climate. Now, of course, within that, we've always had extreme weather events, but it was in the context of a stable climate system. Now, what's happened in the interim is that we have left that stable climate system. We're currently at about 1.2 degrees above pre-industrial. We're heading, according to the WMO, we've got a distinct possibility later this decade of breaching 1.5 degrees above pre-industrial. And this would be the largest, I suppose, heat anomaly, as I say, since the end of the last ice age. Mm. And it takes us basically into conditions completely different to the conditions in which humanity has thrived.
Now, people will say, John, people might say, yes, but, you know, the climate has always changed. We went through many different ages, as you just referenced. But we're talking about changes here that have happened. The changes others might talk of or reference happened over thousands, millions of years. We're talking about very dramatic changes on this planet within a couple of hundred years. There is no historic precedent for that without a major sort of a event happening like a meteor strike or something.
That's exactly right. And you are correct. Our climate changes. And of course, the reason that we know that our climate changes is because of the work done by climatologists. And there's a branch of climatology called paleoclimatology that has actually looked into this in huge detail. And on that, we have instrumental records, like physical records going back from ice cores, 800,000 years. These are Antarctic ice cores. So they give us a physical record of global carbon dioxide levels, almost a million years of straight records. And in all that time, Greg, we have never had more than 300 parts per million of CO2. The reason CO2 is so important is that it is the trace gas that basically traps heat in our atmosphere. Other gases like oxygen and nitrogen are completely opaque to the atmosphere. So CO2 is the gas, and methane, of course. They're the two key gases. Now, what we know is that since pre-industrial, which is really the blink of an eye, it's only 100 years or 150 years, in that time, we've gone from never exceeding 300 parts per million to today's level of 420 parts per million. So we've added about 50% more CO2 through human actions to the global atmosphere in the last 100 years or so, but particularly in the last 30 to 50 years. We've more than doubled it, by the way, since 1990. And that is the fastest rate of change, not in thousands, but in several million years. And it's probably worth mentioning, Greg, that the last time we had over 400 parts per million was about 4 to 5 million years ago. And at that time, global sea levels were 20 meters higher than they are today.
Now, the scientists are as certain as any scientist might be, 98% certain, I believe, that, as you've mentioned, at least one of the next 5 years will be the warmest year on record. Now, some of that obviously is what's going on in terms of the human impact. The El Niño climatic event is also going to impact on that. So this is not necessarily an increase in temperatures that will be sustained either.
That's right. We've just come out of a prolonged La Niña climatic cycle. And in simple terms, that means during La Niña phases, you expect the Earth to be slightly cooler, right? Now, what's happening is the La Niña cycle has become overwhelmed by the global warming signal. And let me give an example of that. Last year, 2022, Europe experienced its hottest summer ever recorded. And that's in over 500 years of instrumental records. And that happened, Greg, during a La Niña cycle. In other words, during a cooling cycle. Now, what scientists are looking at the moment is that we're swinging in back into an El Niño cycle. So that means, in a sense, that what we're going to get is all the additional warming that we have from climate change. And then the cherry on the top, if you like, is an El Niño event. And essentially, an El Niño basically transfers heat energy from the oceans to the atmosphere. That's basically, in simple terms, that's what it does. So it turbocharges the underlying climate signal. And I suppose that's why 1.5 is on the cards. But certainly when I was looking at this a few years ago, the discussions probably up to about 2018, 2020 was that we would not see 1.5 in the 2020s. It would definitely be the 2030s. So what we're seeing really is that the global atmospheric system is more responsive, more sensitive to rising CO2 levels than we feared. Mm-hmm. And and what does this mean in real terms? For example, we know that Europe, apart from that extreme drought conditions of last year, they continued into this year, major rivers drying up, huge economic impacts on food production. And then you see in the last few days, extreme flooding events in Italy. Mm-hmm. So you go, essentially, we're swinging rapidly from massive droughts into unprecedented flooding. Yep. The flooding in Italy, apparently they got a year's worth of rainfall in under 24 hours.
A meter or something, yeah. And John, yeah. Listen, I get why there is a certain amount of people who don't want this to be true. Because we don't want anything bad to be true, do we? And if something's happening on the other side of the world and we can't see it, well, for some, it simply is not happening. And we're here for a fleeting moment and people don't want to have to deal with this or the stress of this. Let the next generation or so. But do you know what I think the penny's really going to drop is when we start seeing climate refugees, effectively, parts of the world that become uninhabitable and they will have to move to survive into other parts of the world that are. And we are in a strip, if I'm not mistaken, that yes, there'll be some climatic changes, but perhaps not as extreme as you might see in other parts of the world. And I think that's when people start going to realise when hundreds of thousands of people to survive start moving to other areas where they can live, that's when people are going to realise that, right, okay, there are things happening that I can't see on other parts of the planet that are now starting to impact me in a way that I'll sit up and notice.
I think that's a very fair summary. It's also incredibly important to remember or to bear in mind that the way people like us live in wealthy parts of the world, like Ireland, is directly impacting on the climate system today and is already severely impacting people in what we call the Global South. So that the Global South at the moment is bearing the brunt of extreme weather events. They're being hit hardest and first, and also they have the least resources. So we have a situation where the way our lifestyles, our extravagant carbon-intensive lifestyles, are already imposing huge costs on the people that you've just described, Greg. Now, science has looked at this very carefully over the last couple of years. And one major study has projected that by between 2050 and 2070, we're looking at areas of the world in which, at the moment, about 3 billion people live, will become too hot for human or other mammal habitation. So we're looking at it's approximately 19% of the world's land surface becoming hotter than it is in the hottest parts of the Sahara Desert today. Now, that leaves us with a really a situation for which there's no precedent in human history. And you mentioned hundreds of thousands of refugees, Greg. Millions. We're looking at hundreds of millions, unfortunately, running into billions. Now, many of those refugees will be internal refugees. So, for example, the greatest number of refugees at the moment aren't people fleeing to Europe. They're actually people going from one country, say in North Africa, to another country, or maybe from Afghanistan into Pakistan, right? They're, so, in fact, the third world, if you like, is already bearing the brunt of massive refugees. But what, of course, you know, alarms people in Europe is the fact that this is going to spill over. And you described it, and I think correctly described it, that we have a very benign maritime influenced climate in Ireland. And somebody has described it as we're a sort of like a lifeboat. Now, the problem with a lifeboat is, first of all, we're a wide open globalized economy. Our economic and particularly our agriculture system is completely connected to the rest of the world. So the idea that Ireland can continue to thrive while the rest of the world falls into chaos is, of course, completely daft.
Yeah, and obviously, and I mean, that's into the future, and it's really at the moment now, really. But you see, the thing that the difficulty I think we have, John, is that, and yes, we can break this down into our emissions per individual, and then sort of all the scales twist. But I don't think the public's ever going to buy into that, unless China, United States, India, Russia, Japan, Germany, Iran, some of the biggest polluters in the world, unless there is a global agreement where everybody actually says, right, okay, we have to save this planet by doing A, B, or C, that's, I can't see us making any inroads into that, because people in Ireland, and as I say, you can break it down into, well, what is it per head of population? You know, you're not as good as you might think you are. I don't think that message is ever going to be sold. And until such time as there is a global proper agreement with proper targets, not building more coal mines, for an example, and more coal burning facilities, or drilling more oil like Trump wants to do, for example, nothing's going to change here unless something drastically changes right across the world and governments come together and say, look, this is what we have to do, and we have to do it now. I can't see this sort of whack-a-mole system of trying to get the Irish to do something while the Chinese aren't, or something along those lines, working. Might be a bit pessimistic and depressing, John, but I just don't see the penny dropping otherwise.
I think that's, again, a fair summary. I would stress that Ireland, while we like to assure ourselves on how small we are, we emit the same amount of CO2 as the equivalent of about 400 million people in sub-Saharan Africa. So don't ever underestimate the impact of the Irish. We punch far above our weight, Greg, in terms of emissions per capita. In fact, our emissions per capita are so high, I think they're the second highest in the European Union, which, of course, is one of the highest things. But the other side of that is that we're a full and equal player in the European Union. And the European Union is one of the most powerful economic and political blocs in the world. We have the ability to influence the policies at EU level. Yes. So the kind of learned helplessness that says we're only small, leave us alone.
Yes.
Unfortunately, and I totally understand your point, unfortunately, that kind of thinking is going to get us all killed.
I get you, but one of our biggest polluters in Europe is Germany, who are deciding to move away from, who are deciding to move almost in the wrong direction in terms of eliminating nuclear, and we know their most recent dependence on gas, because it's, do you know what I mean? I get what you're saying, and I get it, and I want a great future for my children and their children. It's just squaring the circle is, I don't know how we're going to do it unless there's a genuine global buy-in. And maybe that's going to take a catastrophic, a really catastrophic event of some sort or other. I don't know.
And I think you've kind of taken the words out of my mouth. And I mentioned this in the Examiner this morning, that we're getting very, very close to the thresholds, the climatic thresholds, a combination really of temperature and humidity, where basically we're looking at a mass fatality event. We narrowly avoided this in regions of India and Pakistan last year. And remember, Greg, that was without an El Nino. They were probably 2 or 3 degrees centigrade short of a mass fatality event. Now, we're getting very, very close. So my fear is that we will one of these days be back on a program like this talking about it. And we'll have a lot of people gnashing of teeth and saying, why did nobody tell us this is going to happen? How could this have happened? How could we have let this happen? Etc. I think it's important before tragedy strikes to at least have an honest conversation. If in the end of the day, Greg, your listeners, and if we all decide, look, the hell with it, we couldn't be bothered, it's too much trouble, we want our cheap flights, we want our SUVs, et cetera, et cetera. If we're not prepared to make any changes, okay, and we've decided we're just going to run with the system as it is, that's fine. Make that conscious decision. That's your choice.
Yes.
But you better live with that decision. Mm-hmm. And when the hard rain falls, then you need to sit your kids down and say, listen, Daddy and Mummy want to tell you, we knew about this stuff, but you know what? We just didn't care.
Yes, but John, I get you, but we live in a country, and it's not just us. It seems to be every country individually, that everything is a threat to us and our children externally. You know what I mean? It could be the movement of people. It could be policies. It could be nothing is our fault. We talk about what could be coming down the line, yet we live in a country with so many young people in poverty, so many young people harming themselves, so many young people with mental health issues. But instead of talking about that, we talk about what could happen to them from other people. You know, it's like, don't look here, look over there. And we're doing it the same. We'll blame someone else for what you're talking of, I fear, unless we really change how we think. I don't know, John. I've really enjoyed speaking to you. Thanks for your time.
Pleasure, Greg.
Bye-bye, John. John Gibbons, environmental journalist there. And as I say, you know, I know there are many of you listening that think it's all gobbledygook. And then there are others that think that this is the biggest threat to us. And I'm not sure how that all breaks down out there. But I do think we're a million miles away from us really thinking, right, we have to do this now, because as I said to John there, and I think you might as well say the quiet bit out loud, we look around us, we look around the world, we see what's happening in Ukraine, and you should go, well, why should I stop burning turf? Or why should I, my petrol and diesel cost an absolute fortune, or why should I have to burn this type of coal whilst, you know, the fires are burning everywhere else in the world? And I just don't see that being sorted until, as I said to John there, there's some sort of a global thing that goes on. But that's not going to happen anytime soon. So we're going to still having these conversations that pop up now and again, and not much really changes. But your views, please, to 086 60 25,000, WhatsApps and texts, 086 60 25,000. If you're listening outside the Republic, 0035 386 60 25,000. And you can give us a call to 07491 25,000. Okay, I need to take a break because I'm about to pull on my wellies. I'm going to don my overalls, roll up my sleeves, take out the marigolds, my watering can, and I'm going to step into the garden with Paul. Please join me in the garden after these. Paul McLaughlin of Ballacthur Garden Centre joins us in the programme, on the programme now. Paul, good morning to you. How are you getting on? Good to have you with us. Any crack?
No, it's quiet now. Just that garden season's kicking off again, I suppose.
Yeah, so the bedding plant season finally here now. Yes, any exactly. Ambiguity out the window. Mm-hmm. We're in summer.
Yes, officially in summer. You wouldn't think it today out there.
Not
now,
meteorologically speaking, but right. From our perspective, mm-hmm. I think we're in summer starts from the people that look at maps and models, I think, 1st of June. But anyway, who cares? It's the 18th of May.
Yes,
where is the year
enough.
Going? Right, okay. So bedding plants. What are bedding plants?
Bedding plants are generally annuals. They're like the wee flowers you put in this time of year, and they will continue now flowering up to Halloween. The real sort of impact plants for the garden. They're short-lived, but it's a very spectacular life that they live in terms of bringing colour to the garden and everything.
Yeah, and the frost, I mean, it's actually was 1 or 2 degrees, 3 degrees in some parts the last couple of nights, but still, the threat to plants has passed us now, would you say?
Yes, it really has, unless you get an absolutely sort of a fluke of a thing, if you know what
exactly.
I mean. But now, for the most part, it definitely has passed.
And we're starting to see people out in the gardens. I love it. The mower, the sound of the mowers, although, you know, some people obviously don't want to mow, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, exactly. Now, it's good to see people out and about.
You can't say anything anymore now. Yes. I feel like it's almost mowing the lawn's a dirty word.
Mm-hmm. Yes, you have this No Mow May campaign and all that.
Say nothing till you hear more. Mm-hmm. All right, No Mow May. That's a good excuse. I like it. Just don't do it June. Maybe I might do that too. Right, so what's the benefits of bedding plants then?
Bedding plants, once again, just really sort of as a sign of summer. You see that even tidy towns, groups, villages, everything looks brilliant at the minute. Pubs and restaurants have all their flowers out. So it's just real high impact colour for the few months of the summer.
What about location? Is that important?
Location is fairly important. Generally, the first consideration probably you want is to actually put them somewhere where they can be seen very well, in the sense that you have these spectacular looking blooms where you want everybody to enjoy
them. Do they need
them.
Direct sunlight?
Direct sunlight, not particularly. However, they'll perform better in direct sunlight. Any flowering plant generally the more sun it gets, the better it flowers. Generally. Yeah. So the will do all right in a bit of shade, but you'll get a far better display in full sun.
Yeah, and even though it might not be cold as such, wind is not necessarily bedding plants' friends.
No, absolutely. If you get a sort of sudden summer storm, it can obviously break them off and stuff. But even a cold wind, even someone like today, can sort of stunt their growth a wee bit.
Mm.
So generally, but if you think there's a storm coming or even a very breezy day, if you have the ability to move your pot or your window box, move to somewhere, a more sheltered location.
Yeah, but not to the point where you can't enjoy them, because the whole idea of this is, especially in more difficult times, is to a bit of the colour, give yourself a lift, yeah. You know, tidy up, you know, around the house a little bit. So, I mean, they are pretty easy to grow and relatively sturdy, aren't they?
They are very easy to grow, all right. Like, there are a few steps you can take looking after to get the best out of them, but generally just if you keep them watered, they'll grow, aren't you?
Yeah, and it's just like we were the conversation about the lawn. You know, there are your standards, but people, if they want to sort of say, right, this is maybe, you know, more favourable to pollination, you can consider that, can't you, in the choice of plants?
Yeah, funny, in the last few years, there has been a move. People are sort of more conscious of it. Your traditional bedding plant, they're all hybridised to sort of get the best out of the flowers. And generally, some of them weren't particularly good at providing nectar or that, but there are more on the market now. People are going back to older varieties that are actually much better for nature. So if you pick the likes of the biddens there, someone like even the marigolds would be very good for actually pollinating insects. So you're getting the best out of your garden and you're helping your pollinating friends too.
Now, we haven't seen much rain the last week, and we're not going to see much rain for the next week. We're going to get some misty rain, the occasional shower, but for the most part, for the next week, it's going to be dry. This is the food for these plants, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely. And like I say, if you do nothing else, if you keep them watered, they will survive and they will grow happily enough. So it's very important to keep an eye on the water, especially at a time like a day like today is dull. You don't automatically think that they would be dry, but the wee breeze there doesn't belong drying them out, especially something like hanging baskets, because they're stuck up in the air, so they're catching all the wind.
And how often over summer would you add feed in?
Generally, add feed from the start. You'll be, whenever you're doing up your baskets or whenever you're buying your baskets, they will have a certain amount of feed in them.
Mm-hmm.
But because you want so much out of them, it's a good idea to replace the nutrients as you go. So product like Miracle-Gro or Tomato Food every 2 weeks.
Yeah, and when do you deadhead them? Like, when is it a deadhead?
Yes, a deadhead, whenever the flower starts going backwards. Like, it's come, it's done its flower, and it's what I call, it started fading backwards. If you nip that flower off,
it's starting to look a little bit worse for wear.
Exactly.
Right, okay.
Nip him off, and what you're doing there, you're removing the seed from the plant. So the plant goes, oh no, I've lost my seed, I'll produce another flower.
Yeah.
So it'll keep him flowering.
So the sooner you do that, the better then, obviously.
Exactly.
But at the right time,
yeah,
as well.
And it also has a benefit, whereas a lot of time the sort of older flowers fall down into the middle of the plant and can actually sort of look unsightly, and they can cause mildew.
Yeah.
So by removing them, you're just keeping everything tidier.
All right, okay. Now, is there anything we should be looking out for on the plants as we're going out watering them that could bring them back, particularly bedding plants, of course?
Pretty much the biggest thing for bedding plants is your petunias, something like that, there would be green fly or white fly.
Mm-hmm.
Would both attack them. So it's just, if you get into the habit of regularly watering, you'll sort of pick up them sort of infestations or any problems that come along with your basket. So the earlier you see them, the easier they are treated.
So, all right, okay. And how do you treat them? Washing up liquid spray?
Washing up liquid spray, you have the old garlic spray as well.
Sort of, WD-40?
Some people use that around the top of their pots for slugs, actually.
Good stuff,
WD-40 for everything.
I'll tell you, if you ever get lamps, you're particularly in older cars, WD-40 is amazing for anything that's black. But if your lamps on your car are mist, you know when it gets that white mist on it? Spray WD-40 on it, leave it for 5 minutes, scrub it off. It's amazing what it does.
Yeah. I've seen people doing that with toothpaste as well.
Well, WD-40 is the way to go. Mm-hmm. But toothpaste might work. I don't know, but I'll tell you.
Maybe we change your toothbrush after.
I don't use the toothbrush. Are we sponge? But it's amazing how dependent on what's causing it can bring them up. Okay. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I don't know why I was talking about that, but just thought I'd mention it. Someone go out there now. If your lights are fogged over, do you know that kind of white mist that's on them? Get the WD-40, go out, spray it on, give it a rub, and come back and tell us how you get on. 086 60 25000. Right, Paul. Most vegetables in tunnel and glass house are being eaten away soon after germination, despite using ant powder and slug pellets. Cucumber in particular and some others are eaten back to the stem. Any advice and or solutions, please?
Advice or solutions. And if they've been eaten back to the stem, chances are it's not an insect doing it, it's most likely slugs.
Yeah.
So maybe sort of be sort of, if you're using slug pellets, you do get organic slug pellets, and they're based on salts, not in the oil poisons that it used to be. So just sort of be vigilant. If you can, go out even just as it's getting dark, with a torch, and that's when the slugs will be most active. Sort of physically remove them as best you can, and just sort of, if you're using slug pellets, keep up with the slug pellets, then it should be all right.
What about WD-40? No, I'm only joking.
Yeah, possibly.
But so it really is a case of physically sort of saying, there you go.
Pretty much, some people would do a thing called companion planting, in terms you can put in sort of plants that are more attractive to the slugs.
Yeah.
You could actually plant some nasturtiums in your tunnel,
mm-hmm.
and slugs are going to actually naturally go towards them first.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe so that'll sort of attract them away, if you know what I mean. So, but just vigilance probably is the key. But I'd say it'd be most likely slugs.
Yeah, we were talking, or it's been in the news this week about wonky veg.
Mm-hmm.
That we go into the shops and we expect our carrots to be orange and straight and clean, and the same with other vegetables, you know, or potatoes. They all have to look a certain way, aesthetically pleasing, I suppose. Mm-hmm. It's crazy when you think about it, isn't it? You'd wonder what's wrong. I don't think I'd have any problem with a bent carrot. What about you?
Yes, no, absolutely. Like for somebody who grows a lot of stuff, like generally you take a carrot out of the ground, you bring it in, the first thing you do is chop it up. So yeah. whether it was straight or bent doesn't really matter much at that stage.
Yeah, but I think the shops need to trust us. But do people, mm-hmm. maybe they pick through the stuff and go, ugh, that's not
quite,
very nice.
Quite anyway. Probably some market research 20 years ago decided that everything had to be straight
size. We're in a cost of living crisis though, so I think, mm-hmm. you know, they need to give it a go anyway. Speaking of growing carrots, mm-hmm. is it okay to grow carrots in a polytunnel?
Yes, perfectly okay to grow carrots in the polytunnel. They do quite well. And you can actually start them. A lot of people be starting carrots sort of now, April, May. Whereas in the polytunnel, you could start them probably February.
Mm-hmm.
So you have a wee jump start on the year. But now they grow perfectly well in the tunnel.
Right, okay. I have a very old pink rose. It's got lots of black and brown spots on the leaves. What is it? What to do?
Generally, that's a thing called black spot that comes on roses. It's a sort of fungal infection. So it is, you do get sprays for it, sort of your multi-rose, something like that, there would be quite good. But this year, if it's an old rose, chances are it will stand up to infection. So a good feed at this time of year, sort of the healthier the plant is, the better it can stand up to the infection. But at the back end of the year, whenever sort of the flowering season's passed, cut it back well. And it's very actually important to the black spot, the spores from it fall on the ground. And even any dead leaf running lying on the ground. So mm-hmm. it's very important to actually clean up properly around the plant, remove all that stuff and keep it away from the roses. And that should stop it sort of reinfecting next year.
All right. My hydrangea leaves tips are dark.
Yes. Quite common this time of year for the hydrangea leaves, especially in older plants. What has happened there probably is a wee touch of frost earlier in mm-hmm. the year. But shouldn't do it any harm in the wide world.
Are there any do's and don'ts about spraying weed killer? Where we live, a farmer man openly walked the field with a back sprayer. We have young kids, maybe the spray not dangerous, but he had a mask on. And look, it's not just the farming community. I saw someone walking up and down the road
mm-hmm.
with a mask on, full gear on, spraying on the footpath or mm-hmm. alongside the footpath. Now, obviously, kids run in the grass or dogs. Mm-hmm. I don't know what they're spraying, right? We don't know. That's the problem.
Mm-hmm.
But you can understand, as we become more aware, when people see them fully suited up spraying weed killer, you know, what can you do about it? We don't know what's in it. What's mm-hmm. your comment on that, given the limited information?
Yeah, so limited information, but that's, I suppose it's a complex issue in terms of, once again, getting back to your sort of wonky veg, like farmers tend, because they're expected to produce this perfect stuff, they tend to have to use some chemicals and stuff like that, you know. So probably they have to think. Suppose it's good to see that the farmer, to an extent, was protecting himself using a mask and that. In terms of property, it's obviously, I suppose, being a good neighbour to actually be good to inform your neighbours of what you're spraying and what for. And
if you wanted them to know what it was, yeah, okay.
Yeah, but generally a lot of chemicals, a lot of weed killers and stuff, once they actually hit the ground and dry, they're sort of actually inane at that stage, if you know what I mean. But obviously you need to know what you're dealing with.
I have a dog who keeps ripping up the garden and chewing at young fruit trees. Is there anything I can put on the garden and trees to deter the wee bugger from doing it?
Well, I suppose it depends. The way of doing it sort of not, you do get sort of chemicals, or they're sort of based in essential oils, stuff that are supposed to deter dogs and cats. I've seen them working with varying degrees of success. What a lot of people would use for animals, sort of, to get them out of if he is sniffing about, put cayenne pepper down and more or less pepper spray them.
Sure, there's people who use bark collars as well. I know they might be mm-hmm. a little bit controversial. I don't have a dog, so I'm not responsible for their use.
But generally, if you can break the habit before he's going, he will actually, and maybe if he's a young dog as well, once he sort grow of out grows of up, he might grow out of it.
You'll realise it's not really much fun. Okay, could you ask Paul if there is any substance which can be applied to ivy to kill it off? I have it growing through a garden fence. I can't get at the roots to dig it out. So is that the neighbours? Or I don't know, maybe it's just not accessible.
Pretty much ivy would be hard to kill. There are a few different products available. You get sort of brushwood killers that would actually be used in briars and stuff like that. So it's because it's a woody sort of stem, if you know what I mean. But someone like that there, the ideal thing would be just sort of keep snipping it off and snipping it off. And sort of
but there's nothing you can spray onto the end of it that makes it die back as such.
There are a few products all right, but they'd be sort of, they'd be fairly harsh, if you know
toxic
what I mean.
Toxic stuff.
So there would be,
okay. Look out for hedgehogs and feed them cat food. They'll gobble up all the slugs.
Yes, very good point. Actually, a lot of more people are getting
into
that.
I've never seen a hedgehog.
Funny, I've seen a couple already. Yeah. So what do you go? But no, the hedgehog's very
good. I mean, if I was waiting on a hedgehog to land to sort the problem out.
Yes, unfortunately.
Do you know what I mean?
Right. Another thing people are actively trying to attract to the garden would be frogs. Eat away slugs and stuff, you know. Mm. So put in a wee patch of water or something, actually, and create a habitat like that. But like you say, I wouldn't want to be depending on them.
No, you wouldn't. My two apple trees were in bloom. Now blooms are gone. The leaves are black. What could this be?
It sounds like a sort of a blight or something like that on it, if you know what I mean, or some sort of fungal infection. So you would be able to get sprays for it. I'd probably feed the tree at this stage, might sort of bring them on. But as the sort of flower, there was a few harsh days of wind, which can sort of turn the leaves backwards a bit. So hopefully a feedie might snap out of it. But once again, take pictures and bring it to your local garden centre. And they can advise as best they can.
Paul, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you very much
on the show. It's been great having you in again, and as usual, answering all of our questions. And you got to mention garlic spray, which is always good.
Always good.
Chicken poo not featuring as much this year as last year, but the season's young yet.
Exactly. Yeah.
So you know what I mean?
Along those lines, I have a new one for you. Okay. We'll keep it for another day.
Don't ruin it. Don't ruin it. Okay. All will be revealed. Mm-hmm. Is it a poo?
Yes.
Oh, it's very exciting. But it's not chicken poo.
No. It's very exotic.
Okay. Well, next time Paul is on the show, he's going to reveal to you, the loyal listeners of the 9 Till Noon show, a brand new poo, which will be one of his key recommendations in fertilising your plants. So don't miss it. Okay, we'll be back with more on the 9 Till Noon show shortly. But for now, Paul McLaughlin of Ballacdur Garden Centre, thank you very much indeed. Okay, you're very welcome back to the programme, and we're going to talk now about Simply Soap. It's the National Youth Entrepreneurs of the Year overall business award winners for 2023, and the people behind it join us now. Abby Boyle, good morning to you, Abby. Thank you very much for calling in.
Thank you very much for having us, Greg.
It's good to have you in. Also, Amy Hegarty, good morning, Amy.
Hello, good morning.
And Aoife Smith, hi, Aoife.
Hello.
Good to have you with us. And Jane McLean's the programme officer with Froiga. Thanks very much for calling in, Jane.
Thank you, Greg.
All right, Amy, I'll start with you. Talk to us about your product and how you come to feel that there was a gap that needed filling there.
Well, we first came up with a product when we were asked to do a product for our school Christmas market. And we were just kind of talking and brainstorming ideas, and we came up with the idea of soap. No one has ever done soap before in our markets in the school. So we just researched then from there, and the whole business developed then.
Yeah, and Aoife, talk to me about the soap. What's different about this soap?
So our soap uses a goat's milk base, which is something that, you know, is uncommon. So goat's milk is high in vitamin E, which is highly moisturising and very good for the skin. It creates a good lather, and it just, you know, separates our soap from other soaps in the market.
Excellent. And Abby, I love the packaging as well, because, you know, you sell things with your eyes as well as, you know, trying and testing the product.
Aye. So we did a lot of research into other handmade soap companies, and we noticed a common theme of a simplistic, natural theme to the packaging. So we selected a minimalistic font and design, and it really just helped boost our product for what it is, Simply Soap. And the brown paper as well just emphasises the naturalness of it.
Yeah, and a bit of consideration too going into the scents, so that it's, you know, not gender specific, presumably.
Yes, so we have six scents. So we offer lavender, lemongrass, vanilla, and then for a more masculine scent, ocean breeze and citrus mist. And we really wanted to focus on making sure everyone could enjoy our product. So that was an important focus for us.
And Amy, this was a long journey against an awful lot of people to get to where you got today. Presumably, you never thought that you would achieve this level of success.
No, definitely not. I think we just got this far because we really enjoyed it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we just enjoyed every second of it. You know, we're three best friends, and I think we definitely wouldn't have got this far, let alone win, if we didn't enjoy it as much.
Yeah, and just to put it into context, Simply Soap won the title after competing against over 6,000 young entrepreneurs from all over Ireland through a series of local, county, regional and semi-finals, with a total of 186 local competitions taking place, leading to 30 regional finals. And the journey's not finished here, because it now goes on to represent Ireland at the European Youth Entrepreneur Awards in Austria later this year. I mean, Aoife, what a journey you have all been on.
Incredible. Like, it's amazing to think, like, back in September when we got into TY, when we were first told about, you know, creating a business, it's incredible to think how far we've come just together and through the Nifty Fruige program, which was led out in our school. You know, we're very grateful to it, to be a part of it, you know, and it's just been an unreal process all in all.
And was there a lot of sort of tech kind of appy stuff that you were up against? You know, I think that might be what a lot of route. What I'm trying to get at is, I think it seems nice that it seems quite a traditional business that has come out on top. Is there something to that?
I think it's just how authentic we are as a group. You know, we know the ins and outs of our business. We're very, you know, down to earth, and I think it's how we present ourselves as much as our product ourselves, you know, and we're just, yeah, very lucky to work so well together.
Mm. What is the future, Abby, for the company, though? Because, you know, you've hit on something here. It looks like it could be in any shop in the country. Do you know what I mean? This is not something that you're imagining. This is something that's actually happened. So are you producing it to scale at this point? Do you plan to do it? Where are you at in terms of the actual business?
So we are producing in scale. We currently have 150 soap in our stock, and we're looking to be located in Killybegs, and come summer there are 29 cruise liners docking in our town, and we're planning on tending the markets held for these cruise ships for their crew and passengers, and this will be a great opportunity for us to get our product worldwide, because they're coming from all over the world, these cruise ships, and we hope to sell well at them, and we're very grateful for this opportunity.
Yeah, and Amy, is this something that you want to stick with as a team, you know, as an actual income? Is it possible that you can do that and continue with your studies?
Oh, definitely, yeah. It's great. Like, we love making them, and it's very nice product to be able to sell, and we're just grateful for the opportunity to be able to sell them.
Is it a complicated process to create them? We don't need any, you know, you don't want to give the competitors any clues here, right? But is it a complex procedure? Or once you've sort of gotten it down?
Yeah, it's not too complicated. I mean, it was complicated at the start. You know, we went through a lot of trial and error at the very beginning when we were just experimenting. But now that we have it all down, it's easy enough.
And how environmentally friendly is it in terms of its impact on the environment, how it degrades or biodegrades? Was that an important element to all of this for use?
Well, first of all, we buy off an Irish company. So
small footprint like it. Go ahead. Yeah, what's next?
We also use paper as our packaging, so it is biodegradable.
All right, Aoife, is that part of the business ethos as well?
Definitely. I mean, soap in itself obviously wears away, it biodegrades itself, so it's definitely been something that we've thought about, you know, from the start. And yeah, I say we're glad to have something that's environmentally friendly as well, because it's obviously a very topical issue at the minute, and it's something that's being brought forward too, and just more emphasis on it all the time. So
all right, okay, well, let's bring Jane McLean. It's McLean, isn't it?
McLean, yep.
I mean, I try not to say anything obvious, but we are talking about soap, Jane, and I'm sure I'm not the first person to point that out.
Yeah, yeah. No, I know what you're saying, but I think the girls here...
It's like if I was called Greg McRadio. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. I suppose the difference with the girls is that they're exceptional. Their product is exceptional.
It's a full-blown thing, isn't it?
Yeah. Their delivery and their presentations, along, as you said there, the presentation for their in-house competition, their regional finals, their semi-finals, the national finals, and the next step for the girls now is that they go to Austria to compete in the European finals in September. So they didn't get this far without being exceptional in many, many different ways. And they were up against, as you said, over 6,000 young people the Fruyga NIFTY program is an international program. The NIFTY manage Fruyga manage NIFTY within Ireland, but it's an international program, so it's all over America, Asia, India. It's all over Europe. So it's an internationally recognised program, I suppose. And the girls have just done amazingly well to kind of get this far.
I'd imagine everyone at St Catherine's Vocational School in Killybegs really, really proud of what they've achieved, because they have. It's a project, but it is a business, and you can see with the language that they use and what they're achieving that they have gone all in on this.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, no, the school have been extremely supportive, and the school have facilitated NIFTY for many years, and they have a fantastic teacher, Miss Fullerton, who's a great support to the girls as well. And you know, it's her first year with NIFTY, and she's just been absolutely amazing. So we're delighted. The school are amazing. Great school to work with.
All right, Abby, when is the Austria trip later this year? And are yous all going? Yous are a team. You have to, don't you?
Yep, the three of us are going in this September. And we just can't wait. It was a very foreign concept come September when we first heard about maybe going abroad, and the fact that we're actually going to be going on this trip, it's amazing.
But, you know, to borrow a phrase from Katie Taylor, I mean, you want all the belts now. Amy, do you know, why not? You know, you've got this far, why not go over and win the bloody thing?
Yeah, no, it's amazing. I suppose at the very, very beginning, we didn't even imagine us getting this far. So it's just a brilliant opportunity, and we're very happy to have it.
Winning's on the cards.
Yeah, exactly. Anything you want to add as we wrap up, Jane?
Yes, I would just like to say that I suppose we were there on Tuesday in Dublin in the Richmond Barracks, and we had 28 businesses from all over Ireland that competed for our four top awards in NIFTY throughout the year. The girls won obviously the main one, but there are four altogether. But I'd also like to say a huge congratulations to Scullwara Buncrana and the Cairn Donagh Community College, who also won two awards. So Donegal got three out of the four awards, so we flew the flag very high in Donegal on Tuesday. So I just want to say congratulations to everybody, all the young people in Donegal that have done NIFTY throughout the year. They've been absolutely fantastic.
Yeah, and our young people never cease to amaze me. They're amazing. Okay, listen, you're going to have to hook up with us when you're out in Austria. So try and remember that, okay?
Definitely.
Well, beforehand and afterhand, okay? Because I think it's a huge achievement already. Anything else now is gravy. Right, Abby Boyle, Amy Hegarty, Aoife Smith and Jane McLean, all four of you, thank you very much for joining us. Continued success, and thanks for making the trip on.
Thank you.
All right, back with more shortly. Now, exciting times as we talk to Tony Forrester, CEO of the Letterkenny Chamber, because yesterday the Chamber launched its Business Awards in Castle Grove. These are the 2023 Business Awards. Tony, good morning to you.
Good morning, Greg.
Here we are again, another year and another exciting event to unveil. And it's really about getting voting. So talk to us about the awards, Tony.
Yeah, so we're delighted. I can't believe another year has passed, really. Delighted to launch them yesterday, and we've kept our key sponsor, Airgrid, from last year as well, and they're with us for another few years. So that's really good news. We have 16 categories this year, so two or three extra from last year. And that includes a few like Outstanding Small Business, Young Business Person of the Year, which is brand new, and Workplace of the Year. So we're trying to sort of make it as wide as possible so that any type of business could apply.
I'm looking for Radio Presenter of the Year. It must be...
superstar, maybe.
I'm only joking. But looking down the list, and people need to go to letterkennychamber.com/ business awards. Looking down the list too, it's great to see the level of support and sponsorship you have for the various brilliant categories. It just shows the real buy-in from the community too, and also the credibility and profile of these awards.
Absolutely, and we've had some of our sponsors, our category sponsors, with us from the beginning, and that's probably nearly 10 years ago. So they've seen the value of it for their brand, and obviously they want to, I suppose, support the successful businesses we have out there. And at the end of the day, we're a business community. You know, we're an ecosystem of our own. And we really, that goes down to employees, that goes down to everybody, not just the owners of businesses. So it's really important that we have the support of the larger companies in some cases and some smaller businesses who support our awards every year.
Yeah, and there's Best New Business Award. Highland Radio's the sponsor there. You mentioned Young Business Person of the Year, Workplace of the Year, Hall of Fame, Business Person of the Year, and so on. Mm. And I think to, you know, not across the board, but to a great extent, it's still relatively difficult trading conditions. And there's a lot of competition out there between, you know, multinationals, internationals, and online. And a lot of these businesses that will be nominated do operate in those spaces as well. Don't get me wrong. But I think it's really important that the public out there, you know, we often wonder, what can we do that doesn't cost us anything? Well, back your local business, nominate your local business if they mean something to you, and get them hopefully into a shortlist, and who's to say where it could go from there? Because it's a badge of honour that that business then can wear for the entire year and beyond.
It certainly is. We had Annette Houston speaking yesterday from FM Services about that very thing, that they use their application, as they get their staff to help do the applications for the awards. But then they also use them for marketing purposes and for purposes of doing tenders. So people will often ask, you know, what awards have you won? And Letter County Chamber Business Awards is one of them. And putting all that out there, it's such a good thing for a company to do.
And how important is it that you think? How important is it? Do you think that the businesses park their? You know, sometimes we can be a little bit shy to shout from the rooftops of what we're achieving. So, how important do you think it is that businesses do put themselves forward so they can be in the reckoning? I think it's really important.
I think it's really important, and this is one of the things we're always trying. You know, put yourselves forward because you know your business best. Do you know why you're brilliant? And one of the questions we have, every category has about four questions. And one of the questions is, why should you win? And if I talk to businesses face to face, they could tell me everything about themselves and how brilliant they are. But sometimes they're a bit frightened to go forward. But we've found last year with some of our highly commended, so we get three per category. And the winner and two highly commended. They were going out there telling people they were highly commended and as well, which was really good.
Yeah.
And I suppose, as Annette said as well, you know, there's a night out at the end of this. So,
and I like the business.
What can you lose?
Yeah, exactly. I like the Business Through Irish Award as well, because it's not surprisingly sponsored by Lynra Letterkenny, but it also kind of, you know, again, if you are a business that does business through Irish, you know, what a brilliant marketing tool. Again, so throw your name in the hat for that one. There's a full list of categories, and then the voting process. Is there a public voting element to this? And we know that.
What happens next is we ask businesses to nominate themselves in the form. We then, that's open until the 14th of July. And then our judges will look at the shortlisting for that. Just based on what they got in, and we hopefully will send out an independent judge, probably on Zoom actually, to talk to people. Then they come back and make their final decisions essentially. But we usually, what we do with the last three in each category is we usually put it out to a public poll. Just, and part of that's engagement, you know, and we do, judges do take that into consideration.
Brand recognition
as well,
and getting it out there. Yeah, for sure. Okay.
And everyone, I mean, this is all done a lot in social media. So you'll see posts coming up, all the sponsors tagged, and everyone who's involved tagged. So that we want the businesses to, so come September when the shortlists go out, the businesses will start talking about themselves well. We'll also profile them. And I know last year you did great work with us on profiling our businesses when we got to that stage as well.
Mm-hmm. Now, there's many, many categories, and I'm sure all businesses will find a space in one of those. So get nominating yourself. And just in terms of, and in the last 30 seconds, from where must your business operate to be included?
You can be anywhere in Donegal. Lynra Letterkenny in the Irish, Business Through Irish, is the only one that's Letterkenny. And you do not have to be a chamber member to be involved in this. Anyone can apply.
Get your name in the hat. Okay, brilliant stuff.
Yeah.
I'm sure we'll talk again just to remind people as the deadline closes, just to make sure everybody gets an opportunity to nominate themselves. But for now, Tony, thank you very much indeed. Okay.
Thanks, Greg.
And we'll talk about when the event is happening as well. Tony Forrester, CEO of Letterkenny Chamber there. Thank you very much for all of you who listened to the programme, those of you who watched the show. Great to have you on board. We're back with you tomorrow morning from 9 with the Friday panel, talking through some of the big issues of the week. And of course, Michael and Fanul will be in with us from 11 as well, and that and so much more besides. Thanks to Caroline and Niamh, who worked on the show. But for me, Greg Hughes and the team, enjoy the rest of your Thursday.